From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're in a new abnormal, and things like this will be part of our future. And this won't be the beginning. It'll be things like this and worse.
In California, at least 44 people are dead, more than 200 missing, as the state continues to battle the deadliest fire in California history. While President Trump blames poor forest management, Governor Brown says climate change is the issue. We'll go to California for the latest. Then we look at the controversy over President Trump's selection of Matthew Whitaker to be acting Attorney General.
I didn't speak to Matt Whitaker about it. I don't know Matt Whitaker.
I can tell you, Matt Whitaker is a great guy. I mean, I know Matt Whitaker.
The state of Maryland is heading to court today to challenge the legality of Whitaker's appointment. We'll get the latest and look at Whitaker's radical legal views and his ties to a company accused of scamming veterans out of their life savings. Then to Gaza, where six people have died in the heaviest Israeli airstrike since 2014. Targets include one of Gaza's main TV stations. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In California, the death toll from the raging wildfire in Northern California reached at least 42 Monday, making it the deadliest in the state's history. The campfire burned down more than 7,200 structures, most of them homes, and razed most of the city of Paradise. At least 200 people are still missing. In Southern California, at least two people have been killed as the Woolsey and Hill fires continue to burn in Los Angeles and Ventura counties. On Monday, L.A. County Fire Chief Daryl Osby responded to Trump's tweet over the weekend attacking California's forest management and threatening to cut off federal aid, calling Trump's remark hurtful.
I can just tell you that we're in extreme climate change right now. We don't control the climate. We're doing all that we can to prevent incidents and mitigate incidents and save lives.
After headlines, we'll go to California to discuss the links between California's historic wildfires and climate change. In Arizona, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema has won the race for a U.S. Senate seat, defeating Republican and former U.S. Air Force pilot Colonel Martha McSally. Sinema will replace outgoing Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who is retiring. Sinema worked on Ralph Nader's presidential campaign in 2000. She'll become the first openly bisexual senator, the first female senator from Arizona. And it's the first time, it's the first victory, a first time a Democrat has won a U.S. Senate seat in Arizona in 30 years. It means Democrats will have at least 47 seats in the Senate as results from Florida and Mississippi remain uncalled. As the Senate and gubernatorial recounts continue in the state of Florida, President Trump said both races should be called for the Republican candidates, claiming voter fraud without any evidence. Trump tweeted the Florida election should be called in favor of Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis in that large numbers of new ballots showed up out of nowhere and many ballots are missing or forged. An honest vote count is no longer possible. Ballots massively infected must go with election night. Trump's tweet drew outrage and alarm. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders responded on Twitter, "Donald Trump, like his friends in Russia, Saudi Arabia, and North Korea, is an authoritarian leader who does not believe in democracy. The election officials in Florida, Georgia, and Arizona must ignore the rantings of this president and count every vote," Sanders tweeted. In Mississippi, Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith came under increased pressure Monday as video went viral of a remark she made during a campaign stop earlier this month. In it, Hyde-Smith is seen campaigning with a cattle rancher stating, "If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be in the front row." Hyde-Smith's opponent for the Mississippi Senate seat is African-American Mike Espy. Questioned by reporters Monday, Hyde-Smith repeatedly refused to answer questions about her remark.
We put out a statement yesterday, and we stand by that statement.
Could you expand on it then, why you said it, what you meant by it, and why people in the state should not see it as offensive?
We put out the statement yesterday, and it's available, and we stand by that statement.
Are you familiar with Mississippi's history of lynchings?
I put out a statement yesterday. And that's all I'm going to say about it.
Mississippi was once considered the lynching capital of the United States. Hyde Smith and Espy will move to a runoff later this month after neither candidate gained the 50% of votes needed to secure the Senate seat. The Daily Beast is reporting ICE is currently imprisoning a record 44,000 people, an all-time high. The figure is 4,000 more than Congress has granted funding for ICE to hold. ICE and the Department of Homeland Security have not responded to requests to explain where the additional money is coming from. In September, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley revealed the Trump administration transferred nearly $10 million from FEMA to ICE over the summer. This comes as the Washington Post is reporting President Trump is preparing to oust Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. She came under intense fire this summer over the Trump administration's family separation policy, with Democratic lawmakers demanding her resignation. Trump canceled a visit with Nielsen to Texas this week to visit troops at the U.S.-Mexico border after Trump deployed thousands of soldiers ahead of the arrival of several Central American caravans. This comes as human rights groups are seeking to halt Trump's recent order banning immigrants who enter the U.S. outside of legal ports of entry from ever seeking asylum. Details are emerging about the audio recordings that reportedly capture the last moments of the slain Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's life and could directly implicate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in his murder. A member of the Saudi kill team responsible for the assassination at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul reportedly can be heard saying on the phone, quote, tell your boss, and the deed was done, after Khashoggi was murdered. The call is believed to be between Maher Abdul Mutreb, one of the Saudi agents at the consulate, and an aide to the Crown Prince. On Monday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau confirmed Canadian intelligence officials had heard the recordings of Khashoggi's death after Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he'd shared the recordings with the U.S., France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, and others. Meanwhile, a reporter from the Turkish daily pro-government Sabah newspaper told Al Jazeera Khashoggi's final words as heard on the recording were, I'm suffocating. Take this bag off my head. I'm claustrophobic. Amnesty International has withdrawn the Ambassador of Conscience Award, its highest honor, from Burmese leader Aung San Suu Kyi in response to the military atrocities and ongoing persecution of Burma's Rohingya minority. In a letter to Suu Kyi, Amnesty International Secretary General Kumi Naidu writes, you have chosen to overlook and excuse the brutal oppression and crimes against humanity committed by the military against the Rohingya, and your office has actively shielded the military from international scrutiny and accountability. We have also been appalled to witness your administration spread hate narratives against minorities, fostering rather than challenging discrimination and hostility, unquote. This comes as the repatriation of Rohingya refugees from Bangladesh back to Burma is scheduled to start later this week. Many human rights groups warn Burma is not able to guarantee safety to returning refugees, and many are reportedly fleeing camps to avoid having to return to Burma. In Gaza, Israeli air attacks have killed six Palestinians a day after a botched raid by Israel prompted deadly fighting. The airstrikes hit several residential and commercial buildings, including the Al-Aqsa television studios. Israel says one 40-year-old man was killed when a rocket fired by Gaza militants struck his home in southern Israel. Israel says 70 other Israelis were wounded by Palestinian rocket fire, marking it the worst violence since Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza. We'll have more on Gaza later in the broadcast with Palestinian writer, activist, and student Mohammed Shahada. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, an outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus has become the worst in the country's history. Congo's health ministry says nearly 200 people have died of the infectious hemorrhagic fever. About half the victims are from the city of Beni, where recent attacks by armed groups fighting for control of the DRC's mineral wealth have slowed efforts by medical workers to halt the spread of Ebola. The New York Times is reporting North Korea is moving ahead with its ballistic missile program at 16 hidden bases that have been identified in new commercial satellite images. The Times cited photos taken from the company Digital Globe, which appear to show activity around secretive mountain bases. But the photos cited by the Times and then widely reported elsewhere were in fact taken last March, about 2.5 months before North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met with President Trump in Singapore and pledged to disarm his nuclear arsenal. The Vatican has ordered U.S. bishops to halt a planned vote on a range of measures designed to address the ongoing child sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. The order came as over 350 Roman Catholic bishops gathered in Baltimore for their annual conference, where they were set to debate and vote on the reforms. Survivors and sexual abuse advocates condemned the move by the Vatican. This is Ann Barrett Doyle of the advocacy group bishopaccountability.org.
I am stunned and disappointed at the lack of courage being shown by the conference. These are American children being hurt. These are American survivors. These bishops are American citizens. I know that they answer to the Holy See, but there's a bigger imperative here, which is that children and victims need them to step forth and start being responsible leaders of this institution.
Conservative writer, conspiracy theorist Roger Stone associate Jerome Corsi said Monday he expects to be indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller. Corsi told listeners of his daily web show that he had given over 40 hours of interviews to Mueller's team and had been recently told he would be indicted, possibly for lying to federal investigators. At least nine associates of longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone have been questioned by Mueller's team as they investigate possible collusion of Russian agents with the Trump campaign during the 2016 presidential election. Former First Lady Michelle Obama's highly anticipated memoir has been released. In it, Michelle Obama recounts how Trump's birther conspiracy theories against her husband and his, quote, underlying bigotry and xenophobia endangered her family. Michelle Obama also takes aim at Trump's sexism in the book and talks about the challenges of being the first Black First Lady of the United States. The Obamas reportedly received $65 million for a joint book deal last year, of which Michelle Obama's Becoming is the first release. The Wall Street Journal reports retail giant Amazon has selected a pair of cities to host its new expanded headquarters, Crystal City in Arlington, Virginia, and Long Island City in Queens, New York. Amazon's decision came after a 14-month search that saw cities around the U.S. promise tax breaks, taxpayer-funded infrastructure, and business-friendly ordinances in an effort to win what Amazon says will be $5 billion in new investment and thousands of jobs. The watchdog group Good Jobs First has blasted the New York and Virginia deals, writing, citizens have no idea what their elected officials have promised to a company headed by the richest person on earth, but we do know that both deals were negotiated in secret without any public input, unquote. The stock market took a steep plunge Monday, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping 600 points, driven in part by a drop in tech stocks. President Trump took to Twitter to blame Democrats, writing, the prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems is causing the stock market big headaches. And the famed comic writer Stan Lee, creator or co-creator of some of Marvel's most well-known and beloved characters, has died at the age of 95 in Los Angeles. Stan Lee has been credited with helping to propel Marvel Comics to the world's top publisher of comics. He served as editor-in-chief and later publisher for Marvel and created or co-created the widely popular characters Black Panther, Spider-Man, The Fantastic Four, and The Incredible Hulk, among many others. Stan Lee was embroiled in some controversy over his career, as some claimed he stole credit from other artists, focusing the spotlight on himself at the expense of his co-creators. In 1968, Stan Lee penned an essay about the threat of racism, writing, quote, bigotry and racism are among the deadliest social ills plaguing the world today. But unlike a team of costumed supervillains, they can't be halted with a punch in the snoot or a zap from a ray gun. The only way to destroy them is to expose them, to reveal them for the insidious evils they really are. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners across the country and around the world. In California, at least 44 people are dead and more than 200 remain missing as two massive wildfires fueled by easterly winds and an historic drought continue to rage. In Northern California's Butte County, the Camp Fire has become the state's deadliest fire in history after the blaze swept through the town of Paradise, killing 42 people and destroying 7,200 structures. Nearly 6,500 of them are homes. Recovery workers say some victims were reduced to bone fragments, raising the prospect of a much larger death toll as some 228 people remained missing. In Southern California, a 250,000 residents of Los Angeles and Ventura counties were ordered to evacuate the Woolsey Fire, including the entire city of Malibu and parts of the San Fernando Valley. The fire, which has killed at least two people, tore through Oceanside homes as panicked residents sought to escape through a massive traffic jam along the Pacific Coast Highway. The Woolsey Fire began near the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, site of a partial nuclear meltdown nearly 60 years ago. California's Department of Toxic Substances Control said it did not believe the flames kicked up any radioactive materials. On Sunday, Governor Jerry Brown said the fires were driven by climate change and that California needs to learn to adapt.
We're in a new abnormal, and things like this will be part of our future. And this won't be the beginning. It'll be things like this and worse.
The fires are so large they can clearly be seen from space. Smoke and ash have left millions of Californians exposed to air quality rated unhealthy or very unhealthy levels, with residents of Los Angeles, Sacramento, and the Bay Area warned against spending time outdoors. President Trump responded to the fires by blaming California officials and threatening to cut off federal aid. Early Saturday, he tweeted, "There's no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California, except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments," Trump tweeted. It drew outrage from first responders and state officials. This is Los Angeles County Fire Department Chief Daryl Osby.
We're in extreme climate change right now. We don't control the climate. We're doing all that we can to prevent incidents and mitigate incidents and save lives. I personally find that statement unsatisfactory, and it's very hurtful for all first responders that are putting their lives on the line to protect lives and property.
Following a wave of criticism, Trump approved an expedited major disaster declaration for California Monday, unlocking federal funds and resources for those affected by the fires. For more, we go directly to Thousand Oaks, California, where we're joined by climate scientist Glenn McDonald, who, along with his family, had to evacuate his Southern California home on Friday to escape the Woolsey Fire. McDonald is the John Muir Memorial Chair of Geography, director of the White Mountain Research Center, and UCLA Distinguished Professor. Professor McDonald, welcome to Democracy Now! So you had to move out of your home. I mean, Thousand Oaks has been hit so hard. First, the massacre of 12 people at the Country Music Bar. And then, as soon as that happens, people have to clear out, have to evacuate for this horrific fire. I'm so sorry for all you're dealing with. But can you talk about the fire, about Trump saying it's bad for forest management, and about the governor saying this is climate change?
Well, first, thank you very much for having me on the show today. It's a pleasure to speak with you. And you're right, it's been traumatic for our community. My wife and I were at the vigil for the victims of the borderline shooting. And we came home that evening, and at 11:20, we got the first call from the emergency alert system here in Ventura County, telling us that we were under voluntary evacuation. We could look to the ridgeline and see it was glowing red, and I knew it was just a matter of time. So we began to pack, and sure enough, less than an hour later, we hit the call for mandatory evacuation. So it has been a rough time here. About the fire, in some ways, this is a typical late fall, early winter fire event with a very, very high Santa Ana wind speeds, ignition at a time of year when our fuels are absolutely bone dry. And so these sorts of fires are anticipatable. They would be anticipatable without climate change. What climate change is doing, however, is that we see that in the since the year 2000, we've had about 15 of our 20 largest recorded wildfires here in the States, where we have good records. About 15 of those 20 have occurred since the year 2000. And that's really been linked to and coincidental with record temperatures, increasing temperatures that we see in this century. And those high temperatures, they do several things. They, of course, they promote high evaporation rates in the summer when we're not getting any replenishment of water for the fuels. So the fuels become super, super dry. They prolong our fire season. They start it earlier in the spring and they prolong it later into the autumn and into the winter. And they're a driving force in this. So the governor is quite correct. We could anticipate that these sort of events will occur in the future, and they'll become worse. In fact, modeling, trying to look at what will look like at 2100, is pretty universal in saying that our fire frequencies are going to increase, our fire sizes are going to increase. Maybe we'll have at least one model suggests 77% increase in fire activity like this by the time we get to the end of the century. So these temperatures are driving things, and we can attribute those to increased greenhouse gases. But they're not the only thing. Again, we would have these fires regardless of what's going on with the climate, but they might not be as big, they might not be as frequent, they might not be as difficult to fight.
Well, Professor McDonald, given the increased density of population, not only throughout all of California, but especially Southern California, what about the issue of how people get out of harm's way? The problems that have been shown over and over again in terms of evacuation with highways becoming actually potential ways for more people to die as they're trying to escape.
Right. This is, one of the issues that we see in California wildfires. This is a built environment. It's a human environment, how we plan our communities, how we build them. You have to remember that far over 90% of the fires in this state are ignited by humans, by human activity. This is not all fire bugs and stuff. It's an Edison or PG&E line going down. It's a weed clearing machine throwing up a spark. It's someone's car breaking down. And they go to the side of the road and they start a fire. So vast majority of our fires are started by people. As we have more people in the state and we have more people living in the wildland-urban interface zone, we can anticipate that we will have more ignition sources, but we can also anticipate that more people are in harm's way. And we're not going to be able to not have these fires. Pretty much anywhere you build at lower elevations here in the state, you're going to be in a fire zone. You're going to have fuels there. The natural vegetation will burn. So how do you protect yourself when a fire gets going? If we take a look at the deadliest fire that happened, that was not a fire crew related deaths, but of civilians, you go to 1991, the tunnel fire in Oakland, where you had some 25 people lost their lives. A number of them lost their lives in their cars, trying to flee that fire on congested roads in the hillside. The two fatalities in Malibu, my understanding is at this point, were in a car trying to flee the fire. I am sure that many of the fatalities that we find in the Paradise region will be similar. There are roads. If you take a place like Topanga Canyon, you have one way out in each direction, very, very narrow, small roads. You will never get everybody out there in time unless you get them out well before the fire occurs. And I think that in Ventura County, the alert system to tell people to get out, in Los Angeles County, the alert system to tell people to get out, they really work this time. If we look at the size of this fire, we look at the number of structures which were destroyed, over 700, I believe, at this point. We look at its geographic scope. It's terrible that we had fatalities, but we had a very, very small number of fatalities. People obeyed, and our first responders were very good in helping those people that didn't. But really, it's early warning, but it's also people believing that and evacuating, which is what my wife and I did.
The Woolsey Fire began near the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, site of a partial nuclear meltdown nearly 60 years ago. The California Department of Toxic Substances Control said it didn't believe the flames kicked up any radioactive materials? Do you believe that?
You know, again, I simply haven't looked at any of the data from that, so I'm not going to comment one way or the other on that. I'm going to go with their scientists, and if they believe that at this point, I think that would be where I would be. But of course, I would want to see due diligence and obviously some monitoring of what was kicked up. By the way, nuclear waste is not the only thing up at Santa Susana. You know, they disposed of a lot of rocket fuels and things like that. There are other pollutants that are up there, and there is a pretty robust monitoring program. And I think we need to see how that may have exacerbated some of the issues with the Santa Susana test grounds.
And Professor McDonald, I'm wondering if you could comment on the federal response. I'm thinking I see thousands of U.S. Army troops sent by President Trump to the border to protect, supposedly help protect the border against a caravan of Central American refugees. But the president's response to the California fires is basically to condemn the way that California has been handling forest management.
Yeah, I think that was very, very disheartening to see the president, I think, essentially attempting to score some cheap political points, on the backs of people who are suffering here and on the backs of the people, both state and federal agency people who are really battling hard these fires and doing a tremendous job. Enough good cannot be said about the first responders here and in Northern California. And so to get that, you know, instead of the president having our back and showing some empathy, some sympathy, or even some basic understanding of what's going on here, was disheartening. And I think you've heard the responses to that from the leadership of our of state and local firefighting officials. I think they were dismayed by it, and it was plumb out wrong. It really betrayed a lack of understanding. There's no forest management that you're going to put in place for the chaparral or coastal sage scrub vegetation that's burning down here, or grasslands. These are not forests. They're not trees. They're not where thinning or salvage logging is going to do any good. My understanding from the Paradise Fire is a lot of that was carried by grass understory. Some of those forests have burned. They've been naturally thinned. That probably no prescriptive treatment would have done much up there either. Again, I haven't been up there, but that's my understanding from what I've read. And so, you know, the president's words were wrong. I mean, if he would maybe make a visit here and see the types of fuels and see how our communities are configured relative to those fuels, maybe he would be more enlightened. I'm not optimistic about that, but that's where we're at.
We have 10 seconds. What do you say to President Trump about climate change and well-known climate change denier?
Well, you know, we're going to keep paying the price unless we start getting a handle on this and at least start having some very proactive adaptation at a federal level. And we certainly are doing it here in the state.
Glenn McDonald, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Be safe. John Muir Memorial Chair of Geography, Director of the White Mountain Research Center, UCLA, Distinguished Professor, has studied climate change and the causes and impacts of wildfires, evacuated with his family there in Southern California to escape the Woolsey Fire. You can also go to our website at democracynow.org to see our interview with incarcerated firefighters. Yes, about a quarter of the firefighters are prisoners. They make $1 an hour fighting the fires. We visited one of their camps and spoke to them. DemocracyNow.org. We'll be back in 30 seconds. by the Los Angeles Philharmonic and Esa-Pekka Salonen. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we continue to look at the raging wildfires in California, where at least 44 people are dead and more than 200 remain missing as two massive fires across the state continue to rage. The Camp Fire has become the state's deadliest in history after the blaze swept through the town of Paradise, killing 42 people, destroying 7,200 structures, nearly 6,500 of them homes. California Governor Jerry Brown said Sunday the fires were driven by climate change and that California needs to learn to adapt.
We go now, while we're staying in California, we're going to Berkeley, where we're joined by May Bouvey, Executive Director of 350 Action, the political arm of the climate organization 350.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!, May. Can you talk about what's happening where you are in Northern California, and then talk about what 350.org, 350 Action, what you are demanding in response to President Trump saying this is gross forest mismanagement and continuing to deny climate change?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Amy and Juan, and for devoting so much attention to these devastating fires. It was very heartbreaking to hear from Glenn about what their community has gone through, and we're hearing similar stories from throughout our local network of 350 groups throughout the state. And here in the Bay Area, I can say that the air quality this morning seems to be a little bit better, but for the last few days, people have been staying indoors, wearing masks, and the sky is hazy and doesn't feel anything like what the Bay Area typically is like in this time of the year. And I remember that we were on your show just a year ago talking about the Napa and Sonoma fires, which is where I grew up. And so we're really daunted by the reality of the climate impacts that are facing us. And this is what the scientists warned us. We know that every disaster is a compound event, and there are many risk factors. And climate change makes all the risk factors worse for something like a forest fire. Drier conditions, stronger winds, the drought that we're living through have all contributed to a fire season that's longer and more devastating. And all of these stories that we're learning about, entire communities wiped off the map, are the tragedies unfolding around us. And we are so grateful for all the work that's being done in this state and all over the world for people who are living through climate disasters. But these are short-term remedies. I can't emphasize that enough on the show this morning, that we actually must turn our attention to the proactive long-term solutions. And we know what to do about climate change. It is not a mystery. We know that we have to transition our economy off of fossil fuels and to 100% renewable energy. We know that this transition is going to be good for so many reasons. It's going to put millions of people back to work building the green economy that we know we need. And it's going to impact the people who've been most impacted by climate thus far. So to say that this is just one fire season after another without looking at the long term does not do us any good. And so we are turning our attention to calling on elected officials, calling on the new members of Congress to really advocate for this Green New Deal that we need and to put us in a much safer position from these rising climate disasters.
Well, May,
of course,
May, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this, the issue of the long-term solutions in the face of total inaction for the federal government, I'm wondering if you could talk about the lawsuit, but with the help of our children's trust, with a group of young people suing the government over its failure to act on climate change.
We are so celebrating the work of these brave young activists who have brought this incredible suit against the federal government. They just received a stay from the Ninth Circuit Court just recently, and so their case is getting momentum. And what they're claiming is so important for everyone to know about. They are claiming that the federal government's inaction on climate is putting their future at risk, and they are using the courts to demonstrate that. And the courts, not only with climate, but with so many important issues, migration, mass incarceration, the courts are becoming one of our last lines of defenses against this reckless administration. Not only this suit, but a number of cities have brought litigation against the oil industry for climate damages. The city of San Francisco has done this, and numerous others around the country and increasingly around the world. So we know who's responsible for climate change. That's not a mystery either. The solutions are clear and the perpetrators are clear, and people are starting to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable.
In fact, that case, the kids case around climate change that started under Obama, has been given the go-ahead to proceed by the Supreme Court. I also wanted to ask you about another judicial decision, the routing of the Trump administration around the Keystone XL pipeline. On Thursday, a federal judge in Montana temporarily halting the construction of this controversial pipeline, which would carry oil from Canada's tar sands region in Alberta to refineries as far away as the Gulf. The court's decision requiring the Trump administration to more thoroughly review the potential negative impacts of the pipeline on the surrounding environment and climate change. President Obama halted the construction, which is being built by TransCanada. After years of mass protests, he stopped it in 2015, but one of his first official acts as president, Trump reversed the order shortly after and gave the green light for both the Dakota Access Pipeline and Keystone XL. This is an amazing judicial decision, May.
It's a huge blow to the Keystone XL pipeline and to pipeline fights all over the world where people are fighting to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And this was an incredible victory. And the indigenous peoples, the farmers and the ranchers along the route and all of their allies were celebrating this. And no one is going to stop keeping up the pressure, but this is a massive setback. Trump and TransCanada will have to go back to the drawing board and show their work and demonstrate what, frankly, will be incredibly difficult to demonstrate, because we know that tar sands are one of the leading drivers of climate change, and we know that the pipelines out of the tar sands are what help exploit them. And not only that, but the decision also required that there be evidence about the cultural impact of this pipeline. And so there's a lot of aspects that are going to challenge its future, and there was a lot of hard work that helped make this happen.
And May, if you could talk briefly about a couple of defeats that occurred in the elections last week in Colorado and Washington State initiatives pushed by advocates seeking to address climate change.
Well, we went into last week's election clear that the fossil fuel industry is greeting the election of a lot of Republicans into the houses of Congress. And so we were trying to really do some good work to flip the House and to elect candidates who will actually take this issue seriously. And so that was definitely something that was a focus. But there were some real setbacks when it came to ballot initiatives. And we were paying attention to a lot of them, including the ones you mentioned. And in Colorado, what was at stake was a setback that would protect communities from fracking wells being near their homes and schools. And in Washington, what was at stake was an actual means on climate solutions around putting a price on carbon. And in both cases, Big Oil poured in tens of millions of dollars. In Colorado, $41 million, and in Washington, $31.5 million. In Colorado, we were outspent 40-1 by Big Oil. And in both cases, it's crucial to know that when those campaigns began, the public was overwhelmingly supportive of these initiatives. But when you start to warp the political process and drip it in oil money, these are the outcomes that we have. And that is why we are so focused on the need to change the social license of this industry, who caused climate change. They know they caused it, they lie about it, and they profit from it. And here we hear these stories of these massive disasters, and this industry has to be held accountable. So while we did suffer some defeats in those fights, the lines of the battles are increasingly clear, and the movement is strong and resolved to fight.
We want to thank you so much, May Booth, Executive Director of 350 Action, the political arm of the climate organization 350.org. Democracy Now! Will be in Poland for the week of December 10th, covering the UN Climate Summit. So do tune in to our special coverage. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Gaza. Stay with us. Baby. Borders and Promises. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The death toll in Gaza has risen to at least six after Israel launched its heaviest airstrikes on the region since 2014, targeting scores of buildings, including a TV station, Al-Aqsa TV. Israeli airstrikes also reportedly hit dozens of homes. Militants in Gaza responded by launching hundreds of homemade rockets into Israel. One person in Israel was reported killed, a Palestinian man in Ashkelon. 16 others were injured, including at least two critically, the recent escalation began after a team of Israeli commandos drove into the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis Sunday in a clandestine raid that killed seven Hamas members, including a commander. Israel said one of its soldiers had been killed in an exchange of fire before Israel called in tank fire and airstrikes while the commandos escaped back to Israel.
Well, for more, we're joined by Mohammed Shahada, a writer and activist from the Gaza Strip, writes for Haaretz, The Forward, and other publications. Mohammed, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain to us what you understand is happening in Gaza as you join us from Sweden, where you're a student?
Well, it started with Israel carrying out an undercover assassination against the top Hamas leader, Noor Barakah, at the worst and most inexcusable time one could ever think about, only a few days after Hamas and Israel supposedly reached an understanding to restore tranquility and calm and reintroduce progress to Gaza. Once the Israeli cover was blown up, Hamas retaliated with a barrage of improvised primitive projectiles on Israel's south with the aim to draw a red line of deterrence for Israel that it cannot do as it may please in the Gaza Strip. Israel responded immediately with an explicit implementation of the Oxford definition of terrorism, basically intimidating and terrorizing Gaza's civilian caged population as an instrument to achieve political gains, essentially to send strong messages to Hamas and, according to a senior Israeli officer, exact a price from the other side. The bombed buildings are usually pre-designated targets, where Israel's choice of the next target is carefully calibrated in accordance with the desired magnitude of pain it wishes to leave Gaza with in order to teach it a lesson, so that when people wake up, they see destruction, rubble, and funerals everywhere, they would be presumably terrorized back into passivity. This morning, a senior Israeli Air Force commander said that the nature of the targets, quote, are completely different from anything we've known in the past. These targets are of high-rise buildings in the city centers.
Can you talk about the bombing of Al-Aqsa TV in Gaza?
Well, basically, Israel claims to have warned people in advance that the building is going to be targeted, compound for Al-Aqsa TV. However, it doesn't make it any better to give people a choice between losing their constructions or homes or losing their lives. Today, for instance, people were awakened at 4:30 in the morning, in the very early morning, to an Israeli phone call saying you have only 1 minute to leave your homes or else you will die inside them. Afterwards, Al-Yazdi Tower in the very heart of Gaza was obliterated from existence, reduced to rubble and misery. And people, that construction, in addition to seven others, including Al-Aqsa TV compound, used to house tens of Gazan families, civilian families, essentially, including kindergartners, kindergartens and entrepreneurial centers. So what we are seeing here is that Israel is trying to teach Gazans a lesson not to walk out of the line, not to be loud about their slow death by inflicting the severest and most traumatic pain it could afford to do.
Could you talk about the timing of this assassination attempt that touched off this latest troubles, especially in light of the fact that there appeared to be at least some potential for restarting some kind of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians and the involvement of other powers in the region in some sort of mediation?
Well, Gaza has shown extraordinary commitment to overwhelming nonviolence over the last at least 6 months of protests demanding their right to life at the 5-meter fence that entraps the enclave. Eventually, Israel decided that if the protests are distant from the fence, in return, Gaza would be given an increase in the influx of Qatari fuel and money to pay the salaries of government officials and increase the electricity daily dose for Gaza's population. However, once this, ceasefire understanding settled in, Israel seized the opportunity to immediately target Hamas, thinking that they cannot retaliate with the interest of maintaining the ceasefire. We're seeing currently international efforts to restore progress in the Gaza Strip that are being exterminated from existence by the Israeli persistence to play a political game other than caring for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Can you give us the context when you talk about the last 6 months of peaceful protests since March 30th? Over 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza. What is the number? 15,000, 18,000 injured, more than 5,000 of them shot by Israeli soldiers. Can you talk about these ongoing protests and what the demands are now in Gaza?
Well, basically, Gaza has been rendered unlivable by the year 2020 and by the United Nations. The United Nations officials came out recently to say that we've been optimistic about this deadline. Gaza is already, in fact, unlivable. If you look at the humanitarian situation in Gaza, you have an ever-increasing segment of extreme poverty. About 80% of the population depend on food packages and humanitarian aid to survive. And you have 97% of the water unfit for human consumption, totally polluted. For this, Gazans decided to rise against their slow deaths and take initiative with their own hands. People have been marching to the Gaza borders for more than 6 months every Friday and on other days of the week to demand their right to life, to demand that the blockade shall be removed. And Israel time and again refused to acknowledge the basic facts that people in Gaza are caged in a toxic slum from birth to death, where they are being suffocated out of hope, out of life, out of any sense for progress, and hollowed out of their souls eventually. And hence they came to the borders to bring it down, to bring the bars that surround Gaza and besiege it into slow death down. And that's basically what they were demanding, that they shall no longer suffer at this time of their history.
Your final words, we have about 30 seconds, on the situation and what you feel needs to be done.
Well, The Guardian, a couple of years ago, opened an op-ed by saying Palestinian nonviolence should be met by global nonsilence. However, the equation that we have here is that if Gazans do not throw rockets or improvise projectiles, nobody at all listens to them whatsoever. Once these projectiles began to fly over Israel, immediately the international community is concerned with restoring tranquility. However, what is made synonymous to tranquility is restoring the status quo that led to the explosion of these troubles in the first place, the very suffocating status quo. So it's a catch-22 that is being repeated over and over again. What Gaza needs in order to assuage existing problems, including security problems, is the very minimum of human dignity. They need to live as other people around the world, clear and simple.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Mohammed Shahada, writer and activist from Gaza Strip, student of development studies at Lund University in Sweden, where he's speaking to us from. Mohammed writes for Haaretz, The Forward, and other publications. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to our last segment today back here in the United States. Juan?
Well, controversy is growing over President Trump's selection of Matt Whitaker to serve as acting attorney general following the ousting of Jeff Sessions. The state of Maryland is heading to court today to challenge that legality of Whitaker's appointment. Maryland contends that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein should have been named acting attorney general instead of Whitaker, who was not confirmed by the Senate for his previous post, chief of staff to Sessions. Meanwhile, pressure is growing on Whitaker to recuse himself from overseeing special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Political reports, Whitaker is now consulting with ethics officials regarding possible recusal due to his past comments on the Mueller probe and his close relationship with former Trump campaign official Sam Clovis, who has testified before a federal grand jury as part of the probe.
Questions are also being raised about Matt Whitaker's past, including his role at a company called World Patent Marketing. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission shut down the company after a number of inventors, including military veterans, said the company cheated them out of their life savings. As acting attorney general, Whitaker will now oversee the FBI, which is still investigating the company. Whitaker is also facing criticism for his remarks about the role of the judiciary. He's on the record saying the Supreme Court wrongly decided the landmark 1803 case, Marbury versus Madison, which gave courts the power to strike down unconstitutional laws. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Ian Millhiser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice. His recent piece on Whitaker is headlined, this 2014 interview of Trump's acting attorney general is beyond belief. Explain what it is, Ian.
Sure. So, I mean, when you read that interview, the impression you get is someone who's not very sophisticated, who is sometimes making contradictory statements two or three sentences apart, but who really wants to show how radical he is. So, he comes out against he's a climate change denier. He comes out against Obamacare over and over again. And the paragraph that I focused on and that a lot of people focused on says two things. The first, he comes out against Marbury v. Madison, which, like you said, is the Supreme Court decision saying that the Supreme Court is allowed to strike laws down as unconstitutional. And then two sentences later, he says that, oh, and in the New Deal era, the Supreme Court should have struck down things like Social Security and the minimum wage. So, there's a lot of things going on there. But one of the things that's going on is those are just two inconsistent statements. And if this guy had the sort of organized mind that you look for in a potential cabinet official, he wouldn't be making those two statements.
Well, Ian, what about this whole issue of whether it's constitutional for President Trump even to appoint him as attorney general?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a strong argument that he cannot serve as at least as acting attorney general. The Constitution refers to two types of officers who are appointed by the president. Principal officers are officers who are the most senior officers. They answer directly to the president, and they typically have tremendous authority. These are your cabinet secretaries. And then it also refers to inferior officers who are the people who answer to a principal officer or to another inferior officer. The attorney general is a principal officer, and the Constitution says that principal officers have to be confirmed by the Senate. So I think there's a very strong legal argument here that this guy cannot serve as acting attorney general and that Trump needs to find someone else who serves in a Senate confirmed role.
And his comments talk about the theory in the school he comes from that says that the judiciary is not co-equal branch of government with the executive.
I mean, I think it's giving Whitaker a bit too much credit to say that he comes from any particular school of thought. I mean, the only thread that I could see throughout Whitaker's writings and his statements is that he thinks that Republicans should always win. And he sort of vomits out talking points that have been used in the past to justify Republican victories. But again, like, many of his statements are inconsistent with each other. Like, he'll say in one breath that the Supreme Court shouldn't be deciding constitutional cases at all. all, and in the next breath say the Supreme Court should have struck down a bunch of laws that he thinks are unconstitutional. So, you know, he doesn't appear to have any driving legal theory. He just says things that he's heard that lead to the outcomes he likes.
So can you talk about, you know, the story is his friend and ally Clovis, right, who is the Trump campaign manager in Iowa, told him to get on TV, start speaking out, right, against the Mueller probe. You'll get Trump's attention, and then you'll get appointed. And so that's exactly what he did. He said, defund the, yep, Mueller probe. You can do anything you want to shut it down. And he becomes the attorney general. Comment, yep, on that, and Trump saying he doesn't even know the guy, though clearly, right, he's been to the White House scores of times. And yep, Trump himself said that he knew him in a previous comment.
Yeah, apparently he was Trump's spy. Like, he was literally on the phone with Trump, you know, giving information about what's going on in the Justice Department. I mean, let's back up a second. Let's go back to 2 years ago. When Trump came to Washington, he didn't know very many people. And so his original list of appointees were this hodgepodge of, like, people the Republican Party told him to appoint, a few campaign surrogates. There's actually a shocking number of government jobs, including a bunch of ambassadorships that are still open because Trump doesn't know who to appoint to those jobs. And what I think the Whitaker appointment shows is after 2 years in Washington, he's starting to learn who his cronies are. He's starting to learn who the people are who are absolutely reliable, who won't put the rule of law over the rule of Donald Trump. And he's trying to get those people into key jobs. And so that's what I think is driving this appointment. It's that Trump has been here in D.C. long enough that he knows, oh, that guy right there, if I make him attorney general, he'll do whatever I want.
And what do you know about Whitaker's past legal record? And could you compare him in some way, if it's possible, to the person he's supposedly temporarily succeeding, Jeff Sessions?
Right. Jeff Sessions is a terrible racist human being, but he had a pretty typical resume for a cabinet official. You know, he was a U.S. attorney in Alabama. He was attorney general of Alabama. He was United States senator for many years. That's the sort of experience that you normally look for in someone who has that kind of job. And it also included some very serious legal experience. When you look at Whitaker, I mean, Whitaker did serve as a U.S. attorney, but it turns out that, like, he probably got that role because he was one of the officials the Bush administration appointed to bring politically motivated prosecutions. His record before he was attorney general, I mean, he spent a lot of time as a personal injury attorney, which is not the sort of resume line you normally look for in a potential U.S. attorney or in a potential attorney general. So he's kind of this mediocre lawyer who doesn't understand very much about the Constitution, who doesn't know enough to know that he's sometimes saying things in the same paragraph that contradict each other. But what he has done throughout his career, both in the Bush administration and in the Trump administration, shown that he's willing to do the dirty work that the Republican Party wants done, and that's been very good for his career.
Finally, before we go, the latest news in Arizona, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema, mm-hmm, has won the race for U.S. Senate, defeating Republican former U.S. Air Force pilot Colonel, yes, Martha McSally. She replaces outgoing Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who's retiring. Sinema worked for Ralph Nader's presidential campaign in 2000. She becomes the first woman elected to the Senate from Arizona, the first Democrat to win a Senate seat from Arizona in 30 years, the first openly bisexual senator. Talk about the significance of this victory.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal to see a Democrat elected from Alabama. This is from Arizona. This is Barry Goldwater's state. Sinema is a very savvy politician. I've been watching her since she was in the state Senate, and she's just very, very good at reading her electorate. I will say one other thing, though, which is, I mean, it's good news for Democrats that they got this Arizona seat, but the trend we're seeing in the Senate is very frightening because each state gets two senators regardless of how big it is. So Wyoming gets the same number of senators as California, even though Wyoming has 1/68th of the people of California. Republicans tend to be in smaller states. Democrats tend to cluster in urban regions. And so the trend we're seeing in the Senate is very, very frightening and leads to the point where Republicans may have permanent control over the body, and you just don't want one party to have permanent control over an entire house of the legislature. Mm.
And then you have Martha McSally. While she lost, she might well, Senator Kyle, who wanted to retire, could step down, and she could be appointed as the other senator. Then there would be two women representing Arizona. But your point taken. Ian Millhiser, I want to thank you for being with us. There are two Senate races left unresolved. There's the race that goes to a runoff in Mississippi and, of course, Florida. And that is being recounted. Ian Millhiser, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Nermin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tay Murray, Astudio, and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Go to our website, democracynow.org, for all video and audio podcasts and transcripts.